Well, welcome everybody to the second of Dr. Pranjapi's talks. This is technically a seminar rather than a lecture, so there'll be plenty of time for discussion and questions. So today, Dr. Pranjapi is going to continue his theme. Last time he spoke about the death of Gandhi, a very interesting talk that was indeed, and there was an awful lot of questions that arose at that time. So I hope that some of you who are there will remember what your questions and your comments were and perhaps introduce them into our discussion this afternoon as well. So he's going to speak now about Hind Swaraj in our times. So, background, over to you.
Thank you very much, Gavin.
I'll sit back here.
And thank you all for coming. In the recent three-part BBC documentary on Gandhi presented by Mishal Hussain, we saw questions about Hind Swaraj and questions which actually bring us to the heart of what I'm going to talk about. And what her interlocutors told Mishal Hussain is that India, to all appearances, has turned its back on Gandhi by embracing economic liberalism and the pursuit of wealth. My presentation today will try to work out to what extent this is really true. But more significantly, it will ask whether Gandhi's critique of modernity, so uncompromising as expounded in Hind Swaraj, is still relevant. To answer this question, I propose a certain way of reading the text Hind Swaraj, and indeed Gandhi, a new hermeneutics, if you will. And I already introduced this in the last talk by saying that one way we can read Gandhi productively is to look for a consistency in the anubhav, achar, and vichar, or in the experiential base of his life, and then in the thought process that was sort of constructed out of that experiential base, and then finally his conduct. So to look for consistency in these, and thereby to read Gandhi in an exemplary fashion. That is, to read Gandhi as an exemplar, not as an ideologue. So this is the kind of hermeneutics that I had proposed last time, and I want to carry this on forward today. But with this sort of caveat, or with this new challenge, that if you actually read Hind Swaraj in this fashion, at least in a very literal fashion, as might be implied... you can have my chair.
No, come.
No,
absolutely.
No, I can stand. Please, please.
No, there's a chair here.
Oh, there is. Okay.
Nice.
All right. But welcome, anyhow. So, as just to repeat what I said, that last point, that in my first talk I was proposing a certain way of reading Gandhi as an exemplar and not as an ideologue. And when we read Hind Swaraj from such a hermeneutical point of view, it poses special challenges, which is what I'm trying to unpack today. So I have these different sections in this paper, and I'll read through some of them, not all of them, because it's much longer than our time permits. But I do hope we have enough time for a discussion. So I want to start by talking about the composition and textual history of Hind Swaraj. In a way, it's very opportune that we talk about it around this time, because it was published about 100 years ago in 1909. So the details of the composition of Hind Swaraj are available in the complete works of Mahatma Gandhi and in other sources, such as Anthony Parel's edition for Cambridge University Press. Gandhi wrote the book on his return journey from England to South Africa, aboard the SS Kildonan Castle. Now, in another paper, which I'll just touch on very briefly as an aside, I argued that Hind Swaraj is an Indian Ocean text. Though it's been read usually in India as a kind of nationalist text, that is a text that was composed and framed within the discourse of Indian nationalism. But actually, in this other paper, I'm arguing that it's not a nationalist text, but it's an Indian Ocean text, which in a way shows the tensions that you have between the Atlantic Ocean and the Indian Ocean, the two oceans that he traversed on his way back from England to South Africa, and the tension in a way between the metropolis and the colony, but also between an older cosmopolis, a pre-colonial cosmopolis, which was characterized by trade and a kind of hybridity that was produced by centuries of interaction between the western seaboard of India and the islands and later the African continent. So, as I said, there was an older world, you know, the kind of world that that Janet Abou-Legoud talks about in her book Before European Hegemony. But that's another paper. But anyhow, so this is very much a kind of a peculiar kind of text which was composed on a ship. It was not composed on land, you know. Anyhow, so Gandhi had gone to England to lobby for the cause of Indians in South Africa, but had not met much success. During this trip, however, he had occasion to meet, as he himself put it, every shade of Indian expatriate. He was particularly struck by his conversations with the Indian extremists in London, who were seeking training in bomb making and handling of weapons in order to plan a violent overthrow of British rule in India. According to Prabhudas Gandhi, Gandhi wrote the manuscript on the ship's stationery in 10 days between 13th and 22nd of November. So I said we're into November now, it's almost 100 days. The text occupied 275 manuscript pages, so you used up a lot of the ship's stationery. And of which 40 were written with the left hand. So, I mean, the manuscript was composed in this kind of white heat of inspiration. So when his right hand tired and flagged, he switched to his left hand, and which is sort of very peculiar of Gandhi, not only in that it represents his ambidexterity, but also his determination to constantly train himself to do things he was not originally, you know, whatever, equipped to deal with, including cutting his own hair, you know, turning into a cobbler whenever required. Scavenging he did a lot, but just to give you an example of his kind of inventiveness. So, and there is a lot of the left in this book, as I'm going to show. It is a very subversive text in a profound and fundamental way. So, it is believed that Gandhi was inspired to write the book after experiencing a kind of illumination during this journey, where this whole problem, I mean, the book starts with this declaration that there is a wave of Indian home rule sweeping across India. In fact, Hind Swaraj was translated as Indian home rule. So the question that Gandhi was grappling with is that how to attain independence, what is the best way to overthrow the British yoke. And it seemed as if it's on the ship that something clicked, and Gandhi was able to find a kind of formula for this lifelong struggle that he then embarked upon to get rid of colonialism. So it seems as if the book followed this illumination during the journey, and he himself described it as an original book in Gujarati. In the postscript to his letter of 25th November to his friend Herman Kallenbach, who was the first to be informed of it, Gandhi published the first 12 chapters of Hind Swaraj in Gujarati in the 11th December issue of Indian Opinion. This was a multilingual newspaper which he edited himself. So it was published, the first 12 chapters were published in Gujarati on the 11th of December, and the remaining chapters were published in the following week's edition on 18th of December. A month later, in January 1910, it was issued in book form in Gujarati, again from his own printing press, what he called the International Printing Press, on the Phoenix Farm in Natal. Gandhi had begun to discuss its contents with some of his non-Gujarati friends, chiefly Kallenbach. And he dictated an English translation to the latter. In the meanwhile, Gandhi heard that the original Gujarati booklet had been proscribed in India and all the copies seized. So this happened sometime in March 2010. And he hastened with the English publication of the book from his International Printing Press. And this English edition came out on the 20th of March 2010. Now, the standard edition of Hind Swaraj, I mean, up to now, has usually been the revised new edition, which was published by Navjeevan Press in 1938. And Navjeevan was, of course, this printing, I mean, publishing house which Gandhi founded and which became his heir. He had, in fact, he left hardly any property, but he bequeathed the rights of his books and publications to Navjeevan. So, now this 1938 edition is interesting because it was published in order to be circulated amongst some of the leading intellectuals in the West, especially in England at that time, for a special issue of a periodical called the Aryan Path, or the Aryan Path, in a sense, both mean the same thing. But this was a theosophical publication which Annie Besant conducted, and they wanted to discuss Gandhi's Hind Swaraj, and so they created a special edition of this book, which was then circulated to a number of people. Now, there is some more of this that I go through, the different editions that came out. There was an American edition as well, and the changes, the amendations that were made in these editions, but I'm going to skip all of that. But the essential question about the textual history is whether to follow the 1938 edition or to follow Anthony Parel's edition, which he did for Cambridge University Press. Now, what Parel did is he reverted to the 1910 edition, that is that first English edition of Hind Swaraj. And now I had an MPhil student do a dissertation on this. She's compared the two editions thoroughly. And in effect, we found that Parel's own edition does not follow the 1910 edition totally. And between the 1910 and the 1938 edition, there are no substantive changes, but some grammatical corrections and some other corrections. For instance, in the 1910 edition, he called the Assamese a wild tribe, along with Beals and others. And then he apologized for that. Because in a footnote, he published his apology. In the subsequent edition, the Assamese are taken out from that sentence. But and then there are other mistakes, errors in the first edition. For instance, instead of Setu Bandha, which is Rameshwaram, he says Setu Bandha Rameshwaram. Setu Bandha means building a bridge, which is what Ram did mythologically to cross from India to Lanka. But in the first edition, he says Shweta Bindu. Shweta Bindu means white sort of dot or center. So it's not, and then that's corrected. So my real contention, and what my student also discovered, and she's possibly going to publish a portion of it, is that there's really no call to go back to the 1910 edition. It's no more authentic or accurate than the 1938 edition, which Gandhi knew of and wrote a new preface for. And other people wrote that book, looked at the revisions and passed them. In fact, all of Gandhi's texts go through this process of minor revision. So anyhow, I'm skipping all of that. But I'm saying that this has created a kind of confusion about which text is more accurate. And if for no other reason, there is one very good reason why the 1938 edition is more Gandhian, which is it's only 5 rupees, whereas the Cambridge University edition is very expensive, as you can imagine. So I come now to the second part of my presentation, and it's called the idea of Swaraj. The idea of Swaraj is powerful and resonant in India. Like many other terms associated with the anti-imperial struggle, including Swatantra, the very word for freedom in most modern Indian languages, Swaraj also originates in the prehistoric spiritual literature of India, namely the Vedas and the Upanishads. Many people are not aware of this fact. The entire secular vocabulary of modern India, in fact, has its roots in these ancient religious, magical, and mystical texts. Swaraj is no exception. It found a new, largely political expression in the late 19th century, deployed for political purposes by stalwarts such as Dadabhai Navroji, Lokmanya Tilak, Sri Aurobindo, and Mahatma Gandhi, it soon became synonymous with India's demand for independence. But again, it's interesting how the sort of translated or English meaning of Swaraj shifts, because Gandhi says home rule in 1909, and then eventually home rule, which is possibly a kind of dominion status within the empire, then that shifts into its connotation to full independence. And later for Gandhi, Swaraj is not just political independence, it's much more than that, which we can talk about. The point is, it's very interesting to sort of recuperate this ancient genealogy and resonance of the word, because we can't really afford to ignore them. Now, etymologically, the word is a modern sort of shortening of the Sanskrit component Swarajya, so the because it's an abstract noun, so it wouldn't be Swaraj, it should be Swarajya in Sanskrit, and which is made up of Sva plus Rajya. Now, Sva of course means the self, like Sui, you know, in Latin, and Raj, everybody knows, you know, is politics and power and so forth, but according to Nirukta, it's Raj Deepnoti. So Raj is that which shines. So the idea of Raj being rule and power is actually derived from its primary meaning, which is something that's effulgent. And it's interesting because the word Rajat for silver, Rajat is silver, it comes from the same root, Raj. So it's Raj Deepnoti, which means to shine. And you also have similar words, Regina, Rex, from the same root. So what the word actually means, Swarajya actually means not just self-rule, but a kind of self-illumination. So I wanted to kind of recover that older meaning as a way to understand what Gandhi meant by Swaraj. So in India, it is, I think, uniquely so that political independence was expressed in terms of enlightenment and self-illumination. It would seem that without inner wisdom and flowering, no outer political independence was conceivable. Swarajya then is the principle of perfection, of perfect governmentality, because illumination comes from internal order, not from oppression or rule over others. Originally, Swaraj referred to the internal government of a person. Now, this notion of inner governmentality is very different, I might add as a footnote, from what Foucault meant by governmentality, which he meant, you know, by that a kind of, you know, a sort of biopolitical control by the state through the ideological state apparatus and so forth. But in the Upanishads, it means really internal order, in which sort of the government of limbs, the senses, all the different organs, the physical and psychological constituents of the individual were, as it were, in harmony. And when all of these are well governed, a person can rule himself or herself, and such a person is called in the Upanishad Swarat. Hence, Swarajya is that state of self-mastery. The master of one's senses is Swarat. The opposite of Swarat, according to the Upanishads, is Anyarat, someone who's ruled by Anya or others. And the Upanishad clearly says that those who are Anyarat perish, they go to the worlds of the doomed. Synonymous with liberty, freedom and independence, Swaraj also suggests a host of other possibilities for inner illumination and self-realization. Swaraj is thus opposed both to imperialism and to totalitarian forms of government which crush the liberty of both individuals and collectives. That is why the word Swaraj might be preferable to decolonization, because Swaraj is not tied up with the colonizer, as decolonization is. In fact, one's own Swaraj, as Gandhi kept saying, can only help and contribute to the Swaraj of others. In Swaraj, the political and the personal merge, one leading to the other, and the other leading back to the one. Swaraj is also both singular and collective. We cannot be free unless all our brothers and sisters are free, and they cannot be free unless we are free. Swaraj allows us to resist oppression without hatred and violent opposition. Gandhi developed the praxis of Satyagraha, or the insistence on truth or soul force or truth force to fight for the rights of the disarmed and impoverished people of India, keeping such an idea of Swaraj in mind. What Gandhi did, however, is that he transformed the notion of Swaraj from the idea of a person who had internal government over his own body and had self-mastery, and he applied this to the body politic, so that instead of just making it an internal thing, he tried to extend its meaning and apply it in a different fashion. But he retained the original notion of Swaraj as self-restraint and self-regulation. And what Gandhi believed is that if we are self-governing, then the state as we know it will have very little to do. And that is why a lot of people call Gandhi an anarchist, because he was certainly not in favor of a very heavy state machinery and apparatus which would oppress individuals. In fact, for Gandhi, the ideal was a society consisting of highly evolved, self-regulating individuals who respected themselves and others. Such a society did not need policemen, law enforcers, enforcement officers, or a huge bureaucratic apparatus, because each citizen would look out for the welfare of others. The idea of Swaraj also had large-scale ramifications in many areas of Indian thought and culture. In 1928, so when Gandhi was still alive, Krishnachandra Bhattacharya, one of India's leading philosophers, delivered a lecture called Swaraj in Ideas. So then he said that it's not enough to have political freedom, which is what, you know, the Congress and others were fighting for, but that we should have some kind of independence and autonomy intellectually as well. Which was very important, because modern Indian thought was shaped, as it were, by a colonial system of education, which was instituted after Macaulay's infamous minute, where, you know, he said that a single shelf of a European library is worth more than all the literature of India and Arabia. So in a way, it was imperial arrogance which was underwritten into the modern Indian education system. And so even today you have sort of the self-hating Hindu or Indian, you know, as a paradigmatic output of such an education system. Anyhow, so Bhattacharya raised this issue of Swaraj in Ideas, and it's interesting how this didn't die out. And in 1984, there was a special issue of the Indian Philosophical Quarterly, which was entitled Swaraj in Ideas. And what happened in that issue was that, like that Aryan Path issue, where Hind Swaraj was circulated and then people commented on it, this issue, Krishnachandra Bhattacharya's lecture was circulated and many people, contemporary intellectuals, commented on it. So it's a very interesting sort of link. Now, when we go back to the issue of the Aryan Path that I mentioned, it had essays by people like, now we haven't sort of, all these names are no longer as important as they were at one time, but just to tell you some of the people who contributed: Frederick Soddy, G. D. H. Cole, C. Delisle Burns, John Middleton Murray, Hugh Dan Anson Fawcett, Gerald Hurd, Irene Rathbone, and some of these people. Now, and some of the comments are very sort of flattering to the book. For instance, Cole said that Gandhi's case against the West looked infinitely stronger in 1938, I'm quoting, than it did in 1908, when the ephemeral civilization of the West looked stable under Western eyes, unquote. And Burns was impressed by the emphasis in Hind Swaraj upon, quote, moral issues and opposition to the pursuit of private wealth and power. And then Middleton Murray called it a great book and considered it one of the spiritual classics of the world, and compared Gandhi's vision of real Swaraj to the Christian vision of the kingdom of heaven, as you find it in the Sermon on the Mount. For Gerald Hurd, now Hurd was a devotee of Sri Ramakrishna. Hind Swaraj was superior to Rousseau's social contract and to Karl Marx's Das Kapital. Irene Rathbone found the book enormously powerful and felt forced by its tremendous honesty to search, what, as she put it, for her own honesty. And Hugh Fawcett summed up Hind Swaraj as a book whose purpose was, quote, to save India not from Englishmen, but from modern civilization, which is eating into the vitals of the West, unquote. Now I want to, I want to now go to talk a little bit about Hind Swaraj in its own time. Hind Swaraj was, as I said, first published about 100 years ago in 1909. What were the conditions then prevailing which Gandhi felt the need to respond to? As the first line of the very first line of the text makes it clear, he says, "Just at present there is a home rule wave passing over India." This is a remarkable opening for a remarkable tract. Though so far away from India, how emphatically does Gandhi feel the pulse of the nation, heightened by the idea of Swaraj? With all the ambiguities of the word, Swaraj still meant political freedom, autonomy, and the possible end of British rule in the future. This dream of a new India animates the text and also exercises all of Gandhi's moral, mental, and spiritual faculties. This longing for independence thus constitutes the main context of Hind Swaraj. But given such a widespread aspiration, the equally significant fact of the lack of clarity as to the means to achieve it is also evident. Indians did want to be free, but were not very clear how to go about doing so. In the Surat session of the Indian National Congress, held just a couple of years earlier in 1907, the delegates had witnessed violent clashes between the two leading groups, the moderates and the extremists, within the Congress. The Congress had split, with the moderates carrying the day. The moderates, of course, were advocates of a slow process of reform, characterized by prayers, petitions, and protests, the three Ps, as were known in those days. The extremists, on the other hand, championed by Sri Aurobindo, actually, who engineered the split, but the three people were, of course, you know, Lal Pal Bal, that is, Lokmanya Tilak and Raj Bihari Pal and Lala Lajpat Rai. These were considered the three Lal Pal Bal, the three extremists, but it was Sri Aurobindo who partly engineered this split in the Congress. But even the extremists were not clear how to go about achieving freedom. Many of them, in fact, tacitly supported armed revolution. The moderates believed that such a tactic would fail miserably and invite the wrath of the oppressive colonial machinery. The partition of Bengal in 1905 had created great disillusionment of British rule among the Hindu Bengali middle classes, with many a youth turning to terrorism to try to destabilize the state. Most of these attempts at violence, however, did not achieve much except to create a sensation or two. Also noteworthy is the fact that though the Congress was the main political organization in India, there were now other competing forces. The Muslim League was founded in Dhaka in 1906. It would later spearhead the drive to carve out a Muslim state out of undivided India. Its very foundation was premised on the eventuality of the end of British rule and to counter the consequent transfer to the majority Hindu community. A few years later, in 1915, some Hindus also founded an organization, the Hindu Mahasabha, to safeguard the interests of the Hindus. All these groups were, however, without a clear plan of action as to how to proceed to win freedom. Gandhi was in England in 1909 to plead the cause of Indians in South Africa. Though he did not meet with much success, as I've mentioned earlier, he did meet many groups of expatriates. Now, there is evidence to show that he possibly met Savarkar as well, who was in England at that time. The most active of these were, of course, the extremists of various ideological leanings, from right-wing patriots to communists, who were a part of the Ghadar Party. From London, Paris, Vancouver, and California, some of these intrepid young men and women were plotting the overthrow of British rule in India. Among them was Shyamji Krishna Varma, the founder of India House, who gave scholarships to Indians to come to England, ostensibly to study, but actually to learn how to become revolutionaries. Varma was a modernist who wanted India to adopt Western values and, like Japan, resist the West on its own terms. Another influential expatriate was Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, who later became one of the founders of the Hindu Mahasabha. Savarkar was the author of the Indian War of Independence of 1857, which was a nationalist reinterpretation of the unsuccessful revolt in which Indian soldiers of the East India Company rebelled against their British officers and tried to drive the British out of India. Influenced by him, Madanlal Dhingra, a student at Imperial College, assassinated Sir William Curzon Wiley on the 1st of July 1909, on the eve of Gandhi's arrival. Dhingra was hanged, but his act thrilled several Indian revolutionaries, as it deeply disturbed Gandhi. After meeting such expatriate revolutionaries, Gandhi had the major insight that their path of modernization and violence was not suited to the native genius of India. And in partial response to them, he wrote Hind Swaraj, which shows a completely new method to resist imperialism, but one that is based, according to Gandhi, on the ancient civilizational orientation of India. This indeed is the genius of the text. It is based not only on a deep understanding of the native civilization of India, but also on modern Europe and on modernity itself. Now, the important point here is Gandhi does not say, do not use violence because it will not work. That was most likely the position of the moderates, who realized just how superior British armed might was to the disorganized, demoralized, and disarmed Indian populace. The extremists, on the other hand, believed that eventually numbers would favor India. No matter how mighty the British were, when Indians in large numbers took to fighting them, the defeat of the colonizers was inevitable. Gandhi profoundly and fundamentally disagreed with these premises. Again, he did not, as many of his followers argue, that these means should be adopted when they would work. Though a practical man, his advocacy for nonviolence was not based on pragmatism. In other words, a lot of people accepted nonviolence because they said, this is going to be effective, you know, under the circumstances. But for Gandhi, it was an article of faith. And what makes Hind Swaraj so radical, far-reaching, and even original is that it offered a totally unprecedented and novel justification for its advocacy of nonviolent revolution. Gandhi widened and deepened the idea of Swaraj to mean much more than political freedom. Consequently, he also turned the political struggle against British imperialism into something much wider and deeper. He made it a civilizational tussle between a spiritual way of life, which he called Sudhar, or the positive sudhara, the positive flow. But now what sudhar means in modern Indian languages is simply reform. So sudharo, or the positive flow, versus what he called the satanic age, or the Kali Yuga. You see, he uses Kali Yuga in Gujarati, of a body-centric modernity based on materialism. So this is how he defined in Hind Swaraj the real fight. So he said the fight is not just between Indians and the English. And he said there's no point overthrowing English rule if you're going to have exactly the same values and have an English rule without Englishmen. So what he wanted was to alter the very matrix of modernity, to invent a completely new social and moral dynamic for India. In fashioning such a view, Gandhi drew both on traditional Indian sources and on Western contemporary critics such as Thoreau, Ruskin, and Tolstoy. Gandhi strongly criticized modern civilization because, according to him, it multiplied desires without fulfilling them. It used machines to enslave human beings. It was intrinsically violent and environmentally destabilizing and destructive. It was what he called a centrifugal, that is, fragmentary in its thrust. And it made us forget the true goal of our lives, which was moral and spiritual development, and not substitute the pursuit of pleasure and profit for the, I mean, not substitute the pleasure, I mean, sorry, not substitute the pursuit of virtue with the pursuit of pleasure and profit. So, in a way, what Gandhi was doing is he was taking the Purushartha framework, which was dharma, artha, kama, and moksha, the cardinal aims of life being to seek power and material well-being, artha, and to seek pleasure, kama, also aesthetic pleasure and other forms of pleasure, was legitimate and valid, provided these were framed by the overarching concepts of dharma and ultimately of moksha or liberation. Though, of course, moksha was added later. It used to be trivarga in the old texts, and moksha liberation came later. But even so, now what Gandhi was saying is if you take away dharma and moksha and you only have kama and artha, then you're going to have a very destructive society. And this is what he thought modernity was, that modernity took away from the checks and balances which were supposed to hedge our normal propensities and the pursuit of pleasure and power. In Hind Swaraj, Gandhi says that traditional Indian civilization was second to none. By rejecting it in favor of modernity, Indians were not only doing a great disservice to themselves, but were also losing their Indianness. These English-educated, un-Indian Indians, according to Gandhi, were leading the country to become another clone of the modern West, which Gandhi thought would be a great catastrophe. Progress to Gandhi was not to be measured in the multiplication of goods and material achievements, but by the development of character and goodness. Moral and spiritual development, not affluence and material prosperity, were the true signs of progress. To be developed did not necessarily mean to live in big houses with all kinds of gadgets, driving fast cars, riding jetliners, and using the latest technology. These did little to build the human spirit. In fact, Gandhi has a whole thing on speed, because he says that speed is from the devil. I mean, if you want to make everything go faster and faster, it's going to result in moral decline. So the traditional way of Indian life to Gandhi was that human beings were less assertive of their rights, but more aware of their duties and responsibilities to others. And he said that nothing symbolized modernity as much as violence. Violence to nature, violence to other human beings through slavery and colonialism, violence to one's own people through surveillance and the regime of machines, and within society through competitive politics, and within each family through selfish self-assertion of one's desires. Gandhi wanted to combat all these evils through a new method of political struggle, which he called satyagraha, or the insistence on truth. Incidentally, he was looking for a new word to kind of describe what he, you know, and his associates had come up with in South Africa, and he had a competition, so he was very pragmatic, and he announced a prize for anybody who would come up with the best word. So in some ways, he was all for incentives, you know, including material incentives for a good cause. And the word that I think his nephew came up with was sadagraha. And sada means sort of perpetual. Agraha means kind of insistence, so a perpetual insistence. And he took sada to its root word, which was sat, and made it satyagraha instead of sadagraha. Now I'm going to skip a bit and come to actually the form, structure, and rhetoric of Hind Swaraj. The form of Hind Swaraj is, of course, a dialogue. To Gandhi, this was merely a reflection of some of the actual conversations he had. But unwittingly, he puts himself in a longer dialogic tradition of Indian texts, like the Gita, which is a dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna, and the Upanishads, many of which are dialogues. The Tantras are a dialogue between the Devi and Parmeshwara. So he, and Hind Swaraj is a dialogue between a reader and an editor. And the editor is supposed to stand for Gandhi, and the reader is a kind of composite of all the different younger and sort of hot-headed men that he had come across in his various encounters. Now, Gandhi says in his preface to the 1910 English edition, Moreover, the dialogue, as it has been given, actually took place between several friends, mostly readers of the Indian Opinion and myself. Now, what is interesting, however, is that now, you know, in India, much of these dialogues, as indeed in the Socratic dialogues, the dialogue is never between equals. You know, there's always one who knows more than the other, as it were. I mean, the guru and the disciple, or Krishna is actually the Lord, and Arjuna sort of is every man in a certain sense. So, and Gandhi follows that. So though he wants to be democratic in this book, it's like, you know, the two positions are never given equal weightage. So you might actually say that this dialogue is skewed in favor, as it were, of the, you know, editor, who, and the interlocutor is, I mean, the reader is used more as an excuse, you know, to for Gandhi to ventilate his own views and opinions. But what is equally interesting, at least for me, I mean, in other words, what I'm saying is that it's not an entirely democratic dialogue. I mean, the reader's right to dissent is not quite curtailed in the text, but is limited, because what Gandhi does is that he will engage with the reader up to a point of view, then give his opinions, and then just leave it at that. But what is equally important is he never browbeats or limits the reader in any way. He never says, look, you have to follow this because I am saying so. He never lays down the rule. What he does is that he just says, okay, you decide. This is what I think, but now it's up to you. So, but in effect, there are many sort of questions left hanging, that he gives his view, the reader says something, but the matter is not entirely resolved. Gandhi moves on to something else after that. So, I mean, this is, it's not dictatorial, it's not entirely democratic either. The sanctity of the conversation, as I say, is not destroyed by this movement when one topic is dropped and another picked up, because the text remains internally coherent and cogent without demanding a complete agreement either from the reader or from us. So the reader is in a position vis-a-vis Gandhi somewhat akin to what we are. That is that the reader doesn't agree with everything Gandhi says, and indeed it's very hard for us possibly to agree with everything that Gandhi says either. But the point then is that given this kind of structure, what becomes imperative is to articulate the coherence of the text. Now, this is an important challenge, because a lot of people who first read the text dismissed it as the ravings of a crank or a lunatic. And indeed, Gandhi's own political guru, Gokhale, said that within 1 year, Gandhi would forswear all the ideas that were contained in Hind Swaraj. And Gandhi was very respectful of Gokhale, but in fact, he said almost tongue-in-cheek towards the end of his life in the 1940s, he said that he had not, I mean, except for changing one or two words, there was a polite, impolite expression that he had used in Hind Swaraj, where he likened the British Parliament to a sterile woman and a prostitute. So he said, I would not use that word, but other than that, he would, you know, not change anything. And this is the point, that a lot of people, even today, we had a conference on Hind Swaraj, and there was a colleague of mine from JNU, and he quoted these bits in Hind Swaraj, just as I've quoted you this little bit about Gandhi calling the British Parliament, comparing a British Parliament, the British Parliament, which was the mother of parliaments, by the way, I mean, celebrated the world over as the mother of parliaments, he compared it to a sterile woman and a prostitute, and then he goes on to defend why he said that. But, I mean, so this person, who was a colleague of mine from JNU, he quoted all these juicy bits out of Hind Swaraj, out of context, and people who hadn't read the text, I mean, there was a large audience there, they all thought that, I mean, they would have agreed that this text was the ravings of a lunatic, you know. So, as I said, it's important to articulate the coherence of the text, you know. And that is because Hind Swaraj is a difficult text. And what makes it difficult is that it is it's extremely tactless. Now, it's tactless in the sense that it's not impolite. Gandhi's never impolite, even with the reader. But he makes no attempts to try to sort of massage his message to suit the reader. He, in fact, lays down his positions in a very uncompromising fashion. So while Gandhi is very polite to his listener, he does not budge one inch from his views. Indeed, his arguments, though voiced patiently and non-assertively, are actually difficult to accept and challenge us fundamentally. What we find is that Gandhi, though seemingly reasonable, is actually very unreasonable, and which of course throws into doubt what we mean by reasonable. But I use reasonable advisedly because Hinswaraj never gives up the appeal to reason. He always appeals to some form of reason, though I must say that it doesn't stop there. That is, when the appeal to reason sort of falls short of his own expectations, he appeals to one's conscience or some higher moral law, like Thoreau does. So he sees sort of human law sometimes in conflict with a sort of natural law. And then he always invokes this kind of natural or even supernatural law, as it were, to overturn human law. So this is his methodology. Gandhi, unlike the Marxists, does not advocate violent change, but he does advocate a complete overhaul of the system rather than piecemeal changes, though he believes that such change need not be imposed but should be invited, and through the power of love and on the insistence on truth, far-reaching transformations of the individual and society are possible. And that, so there is a method to Gandhi's tactlessness and unreasonableness. Let's look at some of these sort of difficult areas. For one, you might argue that Gandhi does not do justice to modernity. He does not acknowledge its many benefits and achievements. He does not, for instance, acknowledge how much freedom it gives to individuals. Freedom from want, freedom from authority, freedom from dehumanizing work, freedom from bodily limitations, freedom, at least to a certain extent, from disease and early death, and freedom, to choose one's profession, freedom to travel. So liberty of a great, variety of, and different levels, and also, in a sense, freedom from violence at a daily level, because, in a sense, modernity at least attempts to abolish violence from the interpersonal by concentrating all the coercive mechanisms of society in the state. So, people don't carry weapons and fight with one another. Though, again, we don't know, and this is what Gandhi says, domestic violence and other kinds of interpersonal violence have not really been abolished. But modernity would, at its best, want to abolish this kind of violence from our daily lives. But then, as Gandhi says, violence is concentrated in the hands of the state, and the means to eliminate people, like weapons of mass destruction, are so destructive that he in fact says at one point in the state that the older form of fighting to him was better, because for him it was chivalrous that, so he says two brave men measured each other out with their swords and fought, but now you press a button and millions of people die and you don't even see the blood. So, you know, that violence is removed from your, consciousness, and it just becomes some images on television, and you get inured to them, so that the moral horror of violence which you had when people fought each other and hands were cut off or people bled to death, it's sanitized now. You never feel it. This is what Gandhi actually says in Hinswaraj. But now the point is that one of the fundamental critiques of Gandhi of modernity is that he says that so much freedom is actually a license to harm oneself and others, And he says that the real costs of material prosperity have not been calculated. And he also talks about the violence and inequality of modernity itself. And from a Gandhian point of view, simply prolonging human life is not as important as asking what the good life is and what one should actually live for. So a selfish and sensual existence, even if prolonged, may not be worth living, but a very brief but beautiful life devoted to service and truth may be more illuminating to Gandhi. Now, to be fair to Gandhi, in his other writings, he does moderate some of his views against, for instance, the railways and machinery. And he says the human body is also a machine. And he says he's only against those machines which take away human jobs and deny dignity to human beings. Similarly, though a critic of the railways, he used them extensively, as his autobiography and other writings show. Though he was never comfortable with modern medicine, he experimented throughout his life with nature cures of various types and diet reform. So he's got a chapter where he criticizes doctors, and he says doctors encourage disease because they take away the moral dimension. And he says that if you eat too much, instead of getting indigestion, which will then remind you not to eat too much next time, you take a pill and you sort of bypass the ill effects, you know, of your conduct. I mean, this is what he says in the text. And he criticizes lawyers, but he himself was a lawyer. And he was not only a successful lawyer, but he also suggested arbitration instead of litigation to best serve the interests of his clients. And again, unlike modern people, Gandhi advocated self-restraint and abstinence instead of contraception. So he had this long exchange of letters with people in England who were trying to popularize contraception, and he said that that will lead to immorality in society. So, you know, a lot of feminists and others dislike Gandhi for these so-called retrogressive views. And he said that sexual energy should be used either for disciplined and conscious procreation, or for higher ends like altruism and liberation, rather than for pleasure or recreation. So he was completely against recreational sex, which according to him was a hallmark of modern life. Now Gandhi also attacked the British Parliament, as I just said, but he acknowledged that for the time being, the goal of the Congress Party was to attain parliamentary democracy. So you can see how in Hind Swaraj he expresses views in a kind of extreme fashion, and then in his other writings he moderates these views a little bit. Now I would argue that the Gandhi's method in some ways is akin to Christ when he asks the rich man to sell all that he has and follow him, and obviously this rich young man can't do that, and then Christ says it's harder for a rich man to enter heaven than the camel to go through the eye of a needle. Now, how do you interpret that? It's a form of extremism. So Gandhi is a moral extremist, and his method is to offer the fullest and farthest exposition of an idea, to try to follow it himself, but not impose it on anyone else, leaving them to go along as much as is possible, provided that they agreed in principle to the desirability of the idea. Now, I now come to the last part of my paper, which is Hind Swaraj in Our Times, which is what the title of this talk is. Though it has a faithful following, Hind Swaraj poses some peculiar problems to the contemporary reader. To what extent can we go along with Gandhi? This is the central problem. I see the following responses to it. There are those who have embraced modernity and indeed form the majority of us today, Indians or otherwise. To such as these, Gandhi's text is nothing more than the rantings of an impractical man going against the tide of history. From such a point of view, Hind Swaraj has been overtaken and defeated by the onward rush of human progress, especially technological development. It is now a curio, a relic from the past, the last-ditch stand of a man going against his times. But even if of historical importance, outdated and irrelevant today. But among many modern people today, there is a large number who have not quite embraced modernity ideologically, but simply see no choice but to be its subjects. That is, they're not consciously modern, but only modern by default, because we know no other way. Now, I think that for these people who are modern, as it were, without endorsing what modernity stands for, then Hind Swaraj is still a beacon and a wake-up call. And when they read Hind Swaraj, they are profoundly disturbed. And they ask, is Gandhi right? Is modernity inherently evil? Is it indeed self-destructive? Is global warming going to destroy us? I mean, and other forms and lifestyles that we have all adopted. And does it really mean a departure from virtue, which was the traditional aim of life? And even if we do not have clear answers to such questions, a text like Hind Swaraj challenges us to re-examine our lives. Because, as I said in my first talk, Gandhi cannot be appropriated because he's not an ideologue. You can't just say, okay, I believe what he believes. But you have to the extent that you believe, you have to start practicing. So the challenge he poses is much greater. Now, I have a bit of my own stuff here, but I'm going to skip that, about how I tried to deal with this issue about not just Hind Swaraj, but, you know, air conditioning in India, because it, you know, you need more and more electricity, which means you have dams, which means people are ousted, and those ousties whose homes and lands are submerged then land up in the very same cities to service whom those big dams were built in the first place, you know. So it's a kind of huge chain, and it's the whole structural violence that we talk about. And if you forswear, say, air conditioning in India, then in the summer months, your life becomes very difficult. And if you take a trip, your children can have diarrhea. I mean, it's very complicated. So plastics, I mean, it, you know, the kinds of demands that a text like Hind Swaraj and its critique of modernity makes on you can be, you know, as it were, quite, you know, life-changing. But, you know, how far do you go? And this is where, you know, I think that I see Gandhi's own approach, where he says that modernity is a necessary evil, but it is also an unavoidable reality. So we must partake of it, but as minimally as possible. So without embracing some of its underlying values, such as consumerism, disregard for the environment, lack of concern for means as long as the ends are satisfied, its amorality, overabundance of choice, extreme individualism, and so on. Now, of course, this is a certain characterization of modernity, because modernity is also self-correcting. So while we know that much of what we're doing destroys the environment and destroys the habitat in which we live, and therefore in the end will destroy us, I think there's also an understanding that we have to do something about it. So that self-critical possibility of modernity is what I think Gandhi is actually appealing to, and that's what I'm trying to argue. So how does Gandhi cope with it himself? He denounces the railways in Hind Swaraj, but he travels extensively on them and on steamships, which were the most advanced mode of long-distance travel until the aeroplanes came up. He used the telegraph and the telephone, which were also the most advanced means of communications then. He also gave interviews which were broadcast over radio and motion pictures. Now, does this mean he was a hypocrite, or that his practice was at variance with his precepts? That would go contrary to the kind of consistency that Gandhi advocated and invited us to find in his life. So if you follow this exemplary hermeneutics that I was talking about, then a text like Hind Swaraj poses this additional problem. And it seems to me, I mean, what I propose here is that Gandhi upholds the principle in its purest and severest form, relaxing the practice to allow for some flexibility. So as he himself said, the human body itself is a machine. So how could he be inflexibly opposed to all machinery? Now, I do want to stop now in a few minutes, because we should have some time for discussion. So let me see what I can skip. I just want to mention one or two points, and then I can end. I think that what was very important, one of the principles behind Gandhi's critique of modernity, was that ultimately he was for the ennoblement and the liberty of the human spirit. And whenever he found that being reduced or taken away from us, he tried to combat it. And he found that a simpler way of life, which is closer to nature, based on manual labor, enhanced the spirit, while an artificial, indolent, and luxurious life devoted to sense gratification degraded it. And this was the essence of Gandhi's critique of modernity in Hind Swaraj. From this it is clear that it is possible to have a Gandhi-like response to Hind Swaraj itself in our own times. Such an approach would neither try to read the text in a literal or fanatical way, nor would it reject it out of hand altogether. Instead, such an approach would accept some of the key principles and premises of Hind Swaraj, and then leave it to each individual to implement or to follow them in his or her own way. It would also aim more ambitiously at some kind of collective owning up of these principles, including attempts to make them the basis of legislation, city planning, which is already happening in Europe much more than where it's needed in places like India, where you have the inner city as a car-free zone or a pedestrian-only zone. So I think what Hind Swaraj, I mean, I'm arguing at length here that there is a direct line that you can trace from Hind Swaraj to Al Gore, you know, and in a way Gandhi was a deep ecologist before his time, you know, if you look at the concerns he raises in this text. And so Hind Swaraj shows us that at the very least our present way of life is unsustainable and will eventually lead to self-destruction. And the problem, though, and this is what I want to acknowledge, that most of Gandhi's solutions were of the primitive type. That is, he wanted to return, and in that sense he was conservative, that he was trying to revive and return to older modes of dealing with this crisis. And never once does he say that perhaps new technology may give us better answers. Never once does he say, let's try to discover a new source of energy. Let's reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. Instead, he says, let's simplify. Let's reduce our needs. So this is, I think, a problem here. And he himself experimented ceaselessly, but much of this was what we call passive solar energy, return to traditional forms. But he didn't say, okay, let's invest in technology. Let's take the resources that are surplus and invest. He said, before you invest in technology, make sure everybody has education, make sure everybody's well fed, make sure everybody has a dwelling, everybody has food. And you're never going to have, well, I won't say you're never going to have, but for many years in India, you couldn't have that for everyone. So while 60% of our people at independence or more were below the poverty line, the government did invest in technology, did take resources that could have been used elsewhere. And this is what Gandhi opposed. But he didn't say that maybe one day we'll be rich and then let's invest in technology. He said, no, let's reduce our wants, let's share what we have, and let's try to, have an economy which is sustainable. Or in fact, a survival economy rather than an economy of surplus. But ultimately, Gandhi's critique of modernity boils down to violence. Modern life to Gandhi was extremely violent, with a sort of structural violence built into it. This violence was not only directed at nature, but at people. And, because when you're violent to nature, you are violent to yourself, because you dehumanize yourself, you denaturalize yourself, according to Gandhi. And today we know in medical terms that the rise of toxins in our environment, which causes diseases, the chemical pollutants and all the different kinds of toxins, it's reaching alarming levels. And either human beings will have to mutate to be able to cope with these toxins, or they're going to threaten us with all kinds of things, including sterility, cancers, and I think it's all well documented. We have a professor of medical ethics here, and maybe he can visiting and he can talk a bit about this later. So I think that for Gandhi, the violence of modernity was at the heart of his critique. And in Gandhi's time, green technologies were very nascent. But to the extent that was possible for him, he tried to implement them. And his own home, Bapu Kuti in Wardha, is a marvelous expression of his principles of architecture, ventilation, you know, and healthy living. If we have time, I could talk a little more about it. In the post-colonial world, I have no doubt that Gandhi would have continued to use the best ideas and technologies from the West as he did in his own time. Just as he was influenced by the other West of Thoreau, Ruskin, and Tolstoy, today too he would have drawn on the innovations and ideas of that West which wants to save the planet. Gandhi, though the leader of India's national struggle for independence, was actually an international figure. His was a new vernacular cosmopolitanism, not in the homi bhabha sense of the word, though. He was at home in all parts of the world and with all peoples. There was nothing narrow or parochial or chauvinistic about him. Even regarding his non-violence, he was aware that the state would have to use violence from time to time against aggression, and therefore he allowed Indian troops to defend Kashmir against the invading bands of mercenaries from Pakistan soon after independence. While non-violence was his personal creed, he did not wish to impose it on the nation as a whole. His attempts to reach out to Hitler, Mussolini and others failed, and he was aware of it. Therefore, his ideas in Hind Swaraj too need to be mediated rather than taken as gospel truth or applied literally. Overall, I've argued that Hind Swaraj should be contextualized to our own times, neither adopted in its entirety nor rejected out of hand. Indeed, many of its principles need to be accepted but reapplied to our conditions today. As to practice, each individual needs to determine to what extent these principles may actually be carried out and yet strive for some kind of collective action. Now, conclusion. The most radical aspect of Hind Swaraj is Gandhi's rejection of violence as a means to win India's freedom. But perhaps no less radical is his rejection of Western-style modernity. He did not want India to replicate the West's evolutionary trajectory, thus refuting the notion that modernity and its progress were universal. Gandhi makes the profound distinction between a people asking for a restoration of its own civilization as opposed to people asking to emulate another civilization. Writing in Indian Opinion a little before Hind Swaraj, he says, "There is a great difference between a people asking for its own ancient life and a people asking for things that have been wholly invented by somebody else." And he says, "Suppose an Indian said that I'm an authentic Indian nationalist, and what I want is," and I'm quoting Gandhi, "give me the ballot box, give us power, give me the judge's wig. I have a natural right to be prime minister. I have a right to introduce a budget. My soul is starved if I'm excluded from the editorship of Daily Mail," or words to that effect. Now, this is the typical post-colonial, as it were, attitude of, in a way, you know, you harp on the wrongs of the past in order to sort of encash on something today, you know, whether it's tenure, as Alif Derlich says in his book, or some other material gain. What Gandhi says is, in response, I've just quoted him, now I'll quote him some more, he says, "Now this is not so difficult to answer. Even the most sympathetic person may say in reply, what you say is very fine, my good Indian, but it is we who invented all these things. If they are so good as you make out, you owe it to us that you ever heard of them. If they are indeed natural rights, you would never have thought of your natural rights but for us. But this is our first difficulty. The Indian nationalist is not national." Unquote. Unfortunately, India, even after independence, has been ruled by this kind of un-Indian Indian. It is ironic that at Indira Gandhi National Airport, International Airport in New Delhi, the lingua franca is English. If you fly west for 3 hours, you reach a number of small capitals of Arab states such as Abu Dhabi, Doha, where you find a number of people, in fact the majority, speaking Hindi. It is not because these countries have more people of Indian origin than the local Arab population, but because these Indians speak in their own common language, which by consensus or accident happens to be Hindi. Indians in India, however, wish only to speak English. Now, I have a little bit here about how Gandhi was, extremely modern in his own way, though he advocated tradition. And also, he was in some ways very traditional. But what I would really argue is that you can't fit him into either box of tradition or modernity. So that, to conclude, Gandhi criticized modernity as satanic, but he was in several aspects radically modern, being a greater champion of equality and justice and a greater religious reformer than most modernists. Gandhi critiqued both tradition and modernity and does not therefore snugly fit into either category. He was traditional in the sense that he believed that the purpose of life was to attain self-realization or liberation, and the method to achieve this was essentially dharmic, and in that it involved an active engagement in and cultivation of a virtuous life characterized by truth, non-injury, non-possession, right action, devotion to God, and so on. But he was also a great champion, not just of equality and justice, but also of individual freedom, thus making him a greater reformer than simply an upholder of tradition. Thank you very much. In fact, I'll add just one line. I would say that a one-line conclusion would be that just as Gandhi found his own specific way of being modern, I would argue that we have to find our own specific ways of being Gandhian.
Thank you, Michael. Well, I open the floor to discussion and questions.
Yes, Mohit.
Thank you, Makarand. Very interesting presentation. I was extremely sorry that I'm half an hour late.
Okay.
I already informed you.
That's why I gave you a one-line conclusion.
Yes, but I have three comments, Makarand, rather than questions. So
right,
three comments. I think your paper was fascinating in trying to, as far as the narrative and the descriptive structure of the Hind Swaraj. But to me, let's say the discontents of modernity and the Gandhian addressal of these discontents of modernity. And you are arguing that we have to return back to Gandhi to resolve our problems of today. Now, I think today India is, and rather the whole world, is facing a different kind of challenges. And definitely there was one watershed called the neoliberal capitalism, I would say, which is markedly different from the Gandhian era. And we have different sort of problems. So that is one. So should we go back to actually visit all of Gandhi, or only take some parts of Gandhi to resolve our problems of today? And the kind of, because let's say the whole ideal of Gandhi as ideal society of Ramraj, and I would argue that the whole the expansion and extension of the concept of Ramraj is essentially elaborated by the Hindutva force in a sense, which is undemocratic in a sense. And this whole Gandhi's return to religion, and to me, organized religion is essentially political, because the political space is embedded within the internal front of religion, because you have a sense of good and bad, morally, ethically correct, incorrect, devil, evil, so the concept of others and enemies and all. I have two more comments. One is regarding the rhetoric. I think if you engage with the concept of catachresis in the whole rhetoric theory, so you have metaphor, metonymy, synecdoche. But there's something which cannot be explained in terms of words. Let's say the leg of the chair, and Saul Kripke has written Naming a Necessity, where there is nothing called the name of that particular thing. We can just explain in some words. I think Gandhi's Satyagraha is something close to this catachresis. You can't actually explain it, what is it. But you have to, there's no synonym of Satyagraha. You have to actually explain it in a lot of other ways. Third, last comment, I think that there is a strong sense of decontestation among in Gandhi's thought, where Gandhi says that, as you rightly pointed out, that Gandhi has his own position. He doesn't have a kind of dictatorial kind of thing that you have to obey it. But Gandhi is very firm on his position, right? And his whole debate with Bhagat Singh's ideological worldview is basically two conflict of ideological worldview. An ideological worldview is essentially decontested. You can't actually challenge and contest it. Well, in personal life, Gandhi's whole decontestation was limited to Gandhi, but later on, the Gandhians have a kind of a decontestation. This is our world. This should be the way, the kind of thing. This should be the ideal society. And all. So if you can, if your paper was fascinating, but if you can just, try to make it more theoretically dense, in a sense, I think it would be much better.
Should I take all of them and then other things?
Yeah. Oh, just a short. I also think it's an extremely interesting lecture. This concept, Swaraj, actually I'm working with Indonesia, and we find the concept there as well. But in the late colonial system, in the first half of the 20th century, it meant something rather different. Swapraja, that was self-rule, which was held by local rajas under colonial Dutch thumb. So we have actually two rather different meanings, significations of this concept. I think in the Indonesian case, they got it probably via Javanese, which is influenced by Sanskrit, of course. So at that time, when Gandhi took up the pen, what would be the general conception then of Swaraj? I mean, you talked about Upanishads and so on, but Gandhi, of course, was not the only Indian intellectual. We have an enormous output of intellectual writings with the Bengal Renaissance and so on. So what would be the conception of this Swaraj? Was it the concept that could be interpreted in very different ways?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering, especially after watching this BBC documentary about Gandhi, and at the end, the third one at the end, I think the there was interview to this economist, the Indian economist, and he says that probably in this at this moment there is nothing Gandhian about as far as economy system goes in India. There is nothing Gandhian about it. So in that sense, it seems the whole this Gandhian ideology is failed. So I'm just wondering if Gandhi was sort of convenient symbol for the people to come together, rather than he actually had the impact in a sense of transforming people's life.
Yes, I have a slightly different take, and for years now I've been working on Gandhi's time in South Africa, basically. And I had this discussion with Anthony Parel in 1993 when we had that 100
Perhaps you can introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm Victor Lale. And I had a similar question at the conference in 1993, because I am working on Gandhi and the Jews in South Africa.
Right.
And I'm just finishing a biography of Henry Pawlak, his Jewish colleague,
yes, of course,
based on Pawlak's personal papers, which has never been seen by any historian, neither the Indian government and others, which I have in my possession. And it was Pawlak who took a copy of the English edition of Hind Swaraj to India in 1909. And I think one is, you know, are we placing too much emphasis, you know, through modern lenses into what Gandhi wrote in 1909? And secondly, as you yourself have said, it's a question of man in the mirror, where Gandhi is literally talking to himself as he's sailing back to South Africa. There is no, of course, he says he has a discussion with other people. You know, it is very important actually to contextualize, you know, where he wrote it and why he wrote it, and the fact that he wrote in Gujarati. It was basically for the Gujarati readers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tamils, for example, had no clue of it. And if there was not an English translation, and if, you know, we might have not had, or if Gandhi had not become who later on becomes in India, he would have been an irrelevant footnote to history, basically. So this question, I mean, you might be able to answer about Gujarat. He wrote in Gujarati, and the word Swaraj, I mean, if I understood, he only spoke Gujarati, no other language.
No,
in South Africa in 1909.
No.
But this is why I'm asking you this question of, is there a similar word in Gujarati of Swaraj and his connection with Sanskrit or anything?
Yeah.
How did he understand this one?
So maybe I'll address these, and if we have time some more, unless somebody has a... Roger, would you like to please?
Yeah, thank you, Markland. Wonderful talk, and I'm intrigued by the way you bring together so many different ideas and connect between the old and the new, which, as you know, is sort of something I'm trying to do within a sort of context of medicine ethics. But to be quite specific, what I'm slightly intrigued by are the influences on his thinking at that time. You spoke about the white heat of the intensity of writing on a journey, and I can understand that sometimes a journey can sort of be a stimulus to sort of creative thinking and new thoughts. Because you mentioned in passing at the beginning about Annie Besant, and I think on his visit to London at that time, he was meeting with people in the Theosophical Society. I mean, it seems that the underlying concepts that sort of are the embodiment within this work are pure Himalayan in terms of the thinking. And it was interesting in your conclusion when you brought it round to Dharma and away from karma, in a sense. And I'm just wondering what would in your understanding, the key influences were at that particular point in time, 100 years ago, which, you know, just brought on that intensity of thought, because it was clearly so pivotal in terms of his later accomplishments.
Right. Well, maybe I should go in the reverse order, since that's most sort of immediate. But I mean, a lot of work has been done on the influences on Gandhi at that time, and in fact, a little earlier. I mean, he was quite an autodidact, you know, because when he came to England, he realized that, you know, he knew very little, even about India. And what he did was, because he had to, you see, attend these dinners, and I mean, there was not much of a rigorous curriculum to become a barrister. He had to attend like 27 dinners in, every year or something. And he studied and passed the London matriculation on his own, and he even considered for a while getting a liberal education in Oxford or Cambridge. He writes about that in his autobiography, and then he found it was too expensive and that he would not be able to do that as well as get a legal training. But he read extensively. I mean, and he when you said languages, he had a fairly good knowledge of French, so much so that he could look at a translation to see if it was good or not. And he learned Tamil. In fact, he was teaching Tamil in South Africa, though he didn't know it too well himself. But so he was, I mean, I'm saying he was very widely read, but there was this fin de siècle that the end of the century, late 19th century, threw up a lot of very interesting kinds of counterculture people. And he got to know them through vegetarianism, a large number of them, because he was a vegetarianism and a member of the society. So, and certainly he had a correspondence with Tolstoy, who was also an advocate of pacifism. So these, and Ruskin, he read unto this last, and then immediately had it translated into Gujarati, and called it Sarvodaya, you know, and in the end, that's unto this last is like Antodaya, the welfare of the last person in society. So that's Ruskin's argument, that you don't measure, you know, how good a society is by its best. You look at how the worst and the most wretched people live, you know, etc. So these were, you know, Gandhi's influences. But I think that he was already, you know, he already had a moral orientation growing up in a Vaishnav home in Saurashtra, I mean in Porbandar, which was also a place where, you know, Jain and other forms of Hindu and Muslim and other cultures, you know, interacted. So he already had a certain notion, but he read his Gita, he read his Ramayana, he read many of these books when he came to England, actually, and sort of undertook to rediscover himself. And I think his key text was the Gita, to me. And that's why I said that, you know, all these influences were grafted on an orientation that he already had. And one of his great influences was Rai Chand Bhai, who later became a Jain, but was a kind of Hindu mystic to begin with. And he never quite, as I said, left the notion that the purpose of life is to find liberation or realization, and the means to it is through a self-fashioning or a self-culture, sadhana, based on certain you know, time-tested principles, which included, as I said, truth, non-violence, brahmacharya, which are laid down in the Yoga Sutras and in most texts of India. But what he did, which was very different, is that instead of making this a personal pursuit, which is what most people in India did, he made it a political pursuit. You know, he politicized individual liberation and said that to be free, I have to struggle against everybody's oppression and injustice. And in that process, he created a new vocabulary, a new praxis. Now, Victor, to what you were saying, I mean, one part of the question is most easy to answer, which is the so-called technical vocabulary in most modern Indian languages is identical, though its meanings may change a little bit. But if you have a word like Swaraj, it's an invented word. I mean, it's a neologism. The Sanskrit word is Swarajya. It's shortened to Swaraj. And you find the same word in every Indian language. I mean, there's no problem with that. So the word is Swaraj in Gujarati as well. It's not as if it's a different word in another language. And so I think that in terms of this whole Gujarati English business, I think Gandhi was very consciously using his own language because he felt that you could only achieve freedom and decolonization through the use of your own language, like Ngugi Wa Thiong'o says much later. But Gandhi was making this kind of argument of kind of linguistic, you know, self-assertion long ago. And he wrote most of his books in Gujarati, and it's a very simple kind of Gujarati, though he was a great stylist of the English language, you know, of the pithy utterance, you know, of he had a gift for the turn of phrase. He used irony and understatement with great effect. And, I mean, his was the English that was, as it were, influenced by the King James version of the Bible, you know, that kind of classical, you might say, style, which he again imbibed when he was a student in England. And that's when he read the King James version of the Bible, by the way. But he was very conscious that he didn't want to be restricted to Gujarati. He immediately translated Hind Swaraj. It didn't take more than a couple of months. So I don't think that he wanted to make a statement only for Gujarati people at all. In fact, he made an attempt again and again to use a language that many people could understand. And in India, he spoke in Hindi. In all the public meetings, he spoke in Hindi, not in Gujarati. So I don't think that, you know, I mean, you might argue that Gandhi would have been a footnote to history. That's a different issue. But given that Gandhi was not a footnote to history and was a sort of key player, then Hind Swaraj was meant to be a key text of such a player. It was not meant to be something that was written, you know, just for a small audience. Now, Keo, your question about what this person says. In fact, he was not an economist. It was Rudrangshu Mukherjee, who is a kind of editor in the Telegraph, though he's a historian as well. He's a published historian and an Oxford man, if I'm not mistaken, Balliol College. But when you say there's nothing Gandhian, I think it's an exaggeration, because some of those concepts of Gandhi, like, you know, village handicrafts, village industries, Panchayati Raj, these are profoundly a part of the Indian reality today, you know, and khadi is still being produced, and Ila Bhatt has made innovations with that. So it's not as if, so people, what I'm saying is people exaggerate. And the other thing is that though Gandhi says unequivocally that the pursuit of wealth, qua the pursuit of wealth, is morally degrading, Gandhi was a Baniya. He came from the Vaishya community, the wealth. So he had a great sense of what wealth was all about. And he actually invented a new notion called trusteeship, because many of his friends were very wealthy Baniyas like him, including Ghanshyam Das Birla, whose house he stayed in. So Gandhi was not somebody who exalted poverty for the sake of poverty. He thought that money was like an energy which had to be used in the right fashion. And his own accounts were absolutely scrupulous. You know, one of the charges against him was cruelty to his wife. And one reason they say it is that one day Kasturba could not account for like 1 rupee or something of donations in her accounting. And so she had to stay up all night until she figured out where that 1 rupee had gone. But he set up these gigantic institutions and trusts for which public money was raised, and he was very particular that you had to have 100% accountability for public money. And he had a great sense of money. He was always dealing with money. So that when you went to a Gandhi meeting, many of the people, I mean the women were advised to leave their gold bangles at home, because you don't know, the old man will ask you for money for a good cause and you'd be moved to take out your bangles, and you know. So he was not this kind of self, loathing, poverty-seeking man sleeping on a bed of nails. As I said, if you go to Wardha, his home is actually very beautifully designed, you know, and it has a telephone booth in it, you know, a red telephone booth. So I don't think that this notion of Gandhi as a complete pleasure-hating, ascetic, I think that's exaggerated. In fact, you go to his bathroom, that's a window to the man. It's a large room with a screen about going 7 feet up, and then the rest of it is kind of open, so it's full of air. It's got a tub in it, and it's large and roomy, and it's not a dirty, dingy old place like many Indian toilets and bathrooms are. And so he had a sense of aesthetics, a sense of space, and he also, I think, knew very well how to handle money, what the value of money was. So I don't think that he was just a convenient symbol. I agree with you that India under Nehru took a different path, but even Nehru, in the last 2-3 years of his life, he said the old man was right, and you know, even with these big dams, you know, which he called the temples of modern India, the Bhakra Nangal Dam had started silting even by the time Nehru was dying, and he could see, I mean, soil erosion, all these problems in Punjab today. A lot of Punjab is can't be farmed, you know, the amount of soil damage and the chemicals in the soil, they're very large. And if you hadn't invented the dwarf wheat, the Green Revolution, or, I mean, India would have had a catastrophe of starving people in the 60s and 70s. We had a lot of food problems, you know, but, I mean, so technology, Green Revolution, things, which Gandhi didn't account for. He didn't think that, you know, you could feed 10 times the number of people on the same plot of land. And so he was not aware that some of these things could have happened, but maybe if they had happened in his times, he might have endorsed them, you know, because they were pro-human and not anti-human. Now, Swaraj in Indonesia, now the word you used is swapraja. That's a different word from swaraj.
Well, it's interpreted in the same way as self-rule.
Yes, because
and
praja, but praja does not mean... Praja means like a community or rule. In fact, it's interesting, for the word nation in English, in Hind Swaraj, the word nation, in the English version uses nation, but in Gujarati, the word used is praja.
Ah.
But pra and ja is not the same as raj, because I don't know, Gavin, maybe praja, what is the root and where does it come from? Something born of what? Ja means born of.
Pra means people.
People. So,
oh, okay.
You know, it's got a different meaning than Swaraj. So Swapraja means our own people, our own units of rule.
Yes, I see.
But
I see.
Indonesian, Bhasa Indonesia has 65% words from Sanskrit. So
a lot of it.
Yeah,
yes.
So I mean Suharto, Sukarno, all these names, Megawati, Mayawati, you know, these are... So the names and the conceptual framework is derived from Indic sources.
Okay.
So it's not such a big sort of problem to try to reconcile these two. But
okay, sorry.
I'm saying no. I'm saying these are different versions and different, you might say, aspects of self-rule, which became a very resonant thing, not only in India, but in all the colonized world. You know, and India... The influence of decolonizing India was far and wide, you know, and even as Nelson Mandela would acknowledge, I mean, people had asked Nelson Mandela to denounce Gandhi. He never did, you know, because some people said he was racist, he didn't do enough for Africans, meaning black Africans, but he said he was always, and he was the man who founded the first political organization in South Africa, the Natal Indian Congress, founded only a few years after the Indian National Congress. You know, was the first political organization of any kind in all of Africa. So these are, I think, modern times, amazing things. Now, Mohit, coming to your three points. Okay, Now, I start with your first point, which is that should we go back to Gandhi? No, I didn't say that. I've never said either in that talk or in this talk that somehow we should go back to Gandhi. But what I have said is that, you know, because Gandhi is an exemplar, an ideologue, you can't sort of discuss Gandhi the same way that you can discuss, say, Marx. And that's where your point about decontestation, you know, impinges on your first question, which is that ultimately, you know, Gandhi challenges us into a form of praxis. It's not enough just to debate it. And the second thing is that he was not interested in discourse for the sake of discourse. He was a man of action. So Gandhi's decontestation, if anything, was simply, you know, the recourse of a person who had things to do by saying, listen, I'm not going to spend all my time just debating, I have things to do. But yes, Gandhians, if they are decontesting, as you said, a certain terrain, then that's very unfortunate. I mean, as intellectuals, people should engage, and decontestation is certainly not the way. But as I'm saying, that eventually, and this is where I think that a certain form of Gandhism or whatever, neo-Gandhism, departs from conventional academics, which is that conventional academics is, to all appearances, an end in itself. I mean, it does not translate into some form of, you know, personal change or lifestyle change, or does not require a commitment to a certain set of values, etc. I mean, it's just something you do for a living, you know. In a sense, from a Gandhian point of view, it would be very self-serving. It would be very selfish and self-serving, and it would not really conduce to the common well-being as much as, for him, a more engaged academic, you know, even like a Gramscian organic intellectual would be much more worthwhile than somebody who's simply a professional who spins out ideas and has, which have no bearing to his life. Which brings me to your middle question about, Ram Raja and all that. You know, the interesting thing is that Hindutva and the BJP and all of the sort of right-wing political spectrum, they have never said a word about Ram Raja. They don't have the courage. You see, the point is because the thing about Gandhi is that since he doesn't have a guilty conscience, he can use religious vocabulary, you know, with a sense of boldness and inventiveness, and also in a way that can appeal to the masses of people and convey complex, even very modern ideas in a very simple way. So instead of telling people, look, we want justice, we want to get rid of colonizers and all, he'd simply say, we want Ram Raja, and everybody understands that Ram Raja is a system in which nobody goes to bed hungry, and, you know, there's nobody's being killed for their money, there are no thieves. So you get a sense of an ideal kind of social organization without having to explain, you know, complex economic and other ideas. But by Ram Raja, Gandhi certainly did not mean some kind of Hindu fantasy in which only Hindus would rule, you know. So I'm saying that, at least personally, I don't have a problem with Gandhi's religious vocabulary. And the people who do are often people who have problems with all kinds of, all things to do with religion. As you yourself seem to suggest, somehow, that it was always some kind of othering, as you said, and good and evil. And no, I don't think so. I don't think that all religious vocabularies or ideologies are necessarily dualistic or necessarily result in this kind of othering.
Saying that religion, certainly most organized religions, have a
yes.
space.
Yes.
I see religion as a discursive tradition.
Yes.
Where both the space of the power block, which is the ruling classes of
yes.
and the space of the plebs, which is the common people,
yes,
underprivileged underdogs, it has a space for both.
Okay.
And that is why religion has a kind of attraction, an appeal for a huge sectors of population, right?
Yes.
But what I think to say that most organized religions are certainly, or the monotheistic religion as well as the Hindu religion,
yes.
has a sense of, you know, internal frontier of antagonism. Okay? There are a lot of good things about religion.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? There's a lot of things which are real. But what I'm trying to say, this whole duality, or the internal frontier of antagonism between virtues and purity against evil and devil.
Yes.
So that means that the implicit antagonism, the sense of other enemies, all those things. Now, it depends on the particular political actors who can extend and expand those internal frontiers into a political ideology. So let's say I would say confer, you know, but that is why, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical to go back to religion, because when you actually provide religion as a source of emancipation,
yes.
Let's say in a pre-modern world, religion was a political ideology. The whole bifurcation between the church and the state with the modernist Enlightenment period, this whole separation between religion and politics is essentially a modernist project, okay?
Yes.
Which has its own limits, and even Western countries are having a kind of return of the religion, which I have a thesis of a return of the repressed.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but what I'm trying to say is that since you cannot repress religion by just only providing a possibility of religion, itself becomes a kind of return of the repressed in later or sooner as a distorted form. And Hindutva is only a distorted form of the whole Gandhi image of a ideal state.
I've understood what you're saying, but I am simply saying that these are two completely different things that you're lumping together. What I'm saying is that Hindutva and Gandhi represent two contrary impulses, whereas you think one is the extension of the other. I think not. In fact, last time I was saying that Gandhi was such a threat to precisely those forces, and the man who killed him was swearing by this Hindu Rashtra notion, you know. So, I mean, I think what you're doing, in my opinion, is you're lumping together these completely different things in the same group, because to you they both seem to smack of the religious, and I mean there's a problem with this kind of thing. And when you finally, when you talked about the unnameable, now that sounds to me as something very religious, okay, something very,
I can say it's philosophical as well.
Well, but if you look at William James and the varieties of religious experience, he says that, you know, one of the fundamental defining features of the mystical state is that it is noetic, it is ineffable. So this unnameable, and this always takes you to, I mean, even in Marxism, the revolution is a kind of, you know, as a kind of unsurpassable horizon, and, you know, it takes you into precisely those.
Precisely, the Marxism essentially is a continuation of the, you know, Christian eschatology.
Well,
so
you can say that, but I'm saying,
it's
I'm saying that the more,
that.
I'm
so
saying that there is a point in. I'm saying that there is a point in all secular systems of thought which approximate this kind of aporia, where, you know, sort of language starts curving in on itself. You know, you have it in Derrida, you have it in Foucault, you have
yeah.
So there is that, you might want to call it that trace of the religious that you can't abolish. Religious in the sense of, you know, the gesture towards the transcendent, towards the noumenal, away from the phenomenal. And you find it in philosophy, you find it in Heidegger, you find it in Kant, etc. So, you know, in notions of limits to reason. So I'm saying that we're not, even if you're approaching these things from different angles, they're not necessarily completely different creatures. And that, you know, in a way, your own methodology seems to create a dualism where perhaps there's no need for one, you know. But there might be one or two last, or
well,
they're
I
out of time.
I think we should stop now, because
okay.
It's time. Well, thank you very much, Bakarant, for extremely stimulating and talk again, which has made me rethink Gandhi and made Gandhi very relevant, I think, to our contemporary concerns. So please do come again next time. It's Monday, the 16th of November, 2 to 3, the Sanatani Mahatma. I look forward to that very much.
That would be closest. Thank you.